It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The city of Pittsburgh recently received a major grant for public outreach regarding autonomous vehicles in the city. We're going to talk about that and the mayor's recent executive order on autonomous vehicle testing with Karina Ricks, the director of the city's Department of Mobility and Infrastructure. Welcome back to the Confluence.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Specifically, Karina, how would your department use this grant of more than $400,000?
So the principal purpose of the grant is to really engage in robust public dialogue around autonomous vehicles and the promise and perils that they might pose to our cities, to mobility options, to economic development and outlook of workers and others. So the Knight Foundation, who is the funder of this program, is historically a media enterprise. And so having sort of democratic discussions, public dialogue is really at the meat of what they do. So we couldn't be more pleased that they really are seeing that there's been a lack of really informed and engaged and deep diving discussion around autonomous vehicles. There's been a lot of hype, but not a lot of really deliberate discussion around it. And so this gives us the capacity and the opportunity to have those discussions that are so important.
You used the word hype. So is it more than a marketing campaign to get the public to hop on board?
It is definitively not a marketing campaign. It is really meant to be an authentic dialogue. And we need to have this discussion so that I and the mayor and the others in the public sector can really provide public policy guide rails around this new emerging technology so that we can steer it toward the benefits and steer it away from the places of danger that it might go to.
Dialogue that implies two-way, that implies give and take. Am I reading too much into that?
No, it is very much meant to be a give and take conversation so that the people of our city, the people who might participate in this, all are coming in with a common understanding. There are those who will say that autonomous vehicle technology is terrible, that it will erode the fabric of our community, that we shouldn't have robots in these places, and that this is something terribly bad. There are others who will sell this as being the panacea for all things in the urban mobility environment. So what we need to do first and foremost is level set, make sure that everyone is coming into the discussion with true and honest and authentic information, that they understand what these vehicles are, what is the technology that drives them, how do they understand their environment and react to it. So bringing people in first to that same level of understanding that is important to that give and take dialogue.
How would you gauge public acceptance here in Pittsburgh of autonomous vehicles before and after the March 2018 fatal accident in Arizona involving a self-driving car? Has it changed much, do you know?
I don't think it has. I think that Pittsburghers have, they most of them have seen these autonomous vehicles operating around in the street. I think much to the disappointment of many, these autonomous vehicles operate very much the same as regular vehicles. If anything, they travel a little bit slower. They maybe adhere more rigorously to traffic laws, which frustrate drivers that are behind them, who maybe behave a little bit more aggressively on our streets. But they have not had this big transformative kind of impact that is often discussed in the media. They are really just another vehicle out on the streets. And so what we've seen is people taking generally a fairly passive approach to these vehicles, because they don't see them as significant disruptors just yet.
How long will this outreach be through the grant? And is it tied into any timetable when you might expect, when we might see truly autonomous vehicles? In other words, no human drivers on standby.
So this is a 3-year grant. I am under no delusions that there's going to be fully autonomous vehicles within 3 years. That may come to pass. You can never tell the future. But from what I know about the industry and the state of the technology today, it is much farther than that. This really gives us the time and the space and the capacity to have those focused discussions, to have someone that is tied into the public policymaking responsibilities there with the public, listening, bringing back information, challenging questions, challenging assumptions, figuring out what is our position on this technology and what are the actions that we need to take in order to prepare ourselves for this. I think truly autonomous mobility in our city or any city is more than a decade away.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Karina Ricks, the director of the Department of Mobility and infrastructure for the city of Pittsburgh. Karina, there's been criticism specifically from the group Pittsburgh for Public Transit that the city has been prioritizing autonomous vehicles over other traditional methods of providing mobility. Has the city focused too much attention on autonomous vehicles versus old standbys, shall we say?
Well, again, there is no truly autonomous vehicle in the city today or in practice. So there is no autonomous mobility being provided by any technology anywhere. So I think that that is not a correct characterization of what the city is doing. Are we looking to see if there is some value in this technology that could lower the marginal cost of transportation for people? Are there ways that we can use this to enhance and expand mobility and actually bring more riders to conventional transit? Absolutely. We're keeping our minds open about what that might be, but we're not pushing a particular agenda.
You mentioned the mobility. There were public comments at a recent city council meeting regarding the acceptance of the grant, as well as the proposed autonomous shuttle, again, proposed between Oakland and Hazelwood. Specifically, the shuttle would actually maybe decrease access for people who use wheelchairs and walkers. Your reaction to that?
So I would categorize it not as a proposed autonomous shuttle, but as a not precluded mobility option. So we are looking at because when we build infrastructure, we are looking at making significant improvements for mobility of all types in the Junction Hollow corridor between Oakland and Hazelwood and Hazelwood Green. What we want to do is expand mobility. But when we make those infrastructure improvements, they will be in place for 100 years. So we need to really be cognizant about what might be that future and what role it might play. There are certain uses that in discussions with stakeholders there, we are explicitly excluding. It will not be a public road the way that other streets are. It will not be available, I'm sorry, for you or for any other individual to travel on through that corridor. It is a park, and it is there for more affordable, mass-provided mobility options. Again, when we introduce any kind of new mobility, it is really incumbent on us to make sure that that mobility option is available to people of all abilities.
To clarify, what is the difference? How do you see the difference between proposed and not precluded?
Well, proposed indicates that there is a plan on the table to bring that kind of service. Not precluded means that we are building a facility on which at some point this kind of operation may be permitted and may serve a purpose. But there is not a proposal at this moment to bring service on that corridor.
The mayor's executive order that he issued in March directs your department to develop guidelines for testing.
So the guidelines were issued concurrent with the release of the mayor's executive order. So the guidelines established what we required of any enterprise that wished to do autonomous vehicle testing on our city streets. They were required to provide us with information about their company, the number of vehicles, where they would be testing, what the methodology for testing would be. They needed to acknowledge these, what we call the Pittsburgh Principles, which is a set of value statements that were crafted by a diverse group of stakeholders, of which Pittsburghers for Public Transit and Bike Pittsburgh and other stakeholders were a part, that we required that these autonomous vehicle companies acknowledge the statement of values and respond to it as to how they would be serving one or more of those elements. They did provide us that information. They were giving 30 days to adhere to the guidelines and submit that information to us. I'm happy to say that all five testers who are in the city today all complied. And today we know a lot more about what's happening with autonomous vehicle testing in our city than we knew in February.
And those five are Aptiv, Argo AI, Aurora Innovation, CMU, and Uber.
That's correct.
All right. Guidelines. The city doesn't have the authority, or does it, to issue requirements? Isn't that up to the state?
So I'd prefer not to opine on that position. So we've taken the position that we would rather work with the industry that's here today rather than set up an immediately adversarial role in which we need to test the boundaries of how much authority the city has versus what authority is exclusively held by the Commonwealth. To date, those companies have given great deference to the instructions that the city has given them. I think that we don't necessarily want to test the waters to discover whether they actually have to do that or not. We would rather continue with this voluntary arrangement that we have. If there comes a day when these companies choose not to, to demonstrate that deference to the city, perhaps we might then have to explore what authorities truly exist at the city level. But since we don't know the answer to that, we might prefer not to ask that question.
To clarify, the five entities are testing, correct?
That's correct.
And all have agreed to the guidelines? How would you put it?
All have complied with the guidelines. In the course of developing the guidelines, we did meet with members of the industry that's testing here. I will tell you that there are elements in those guidelines that the industry is not terribly happy about. They would prefer not to provide quite as much information, perhaps, as the guidelines require them to. It was a very much a give and take kind of discussion in the development of the guidelines, and there were places where the city simply had to draw the line and say, we will not go back from this requirement. You will need to adhere to this. And again, the industry prefers to work with the city rather than sort of press the limits of those boundaries. And so they are adhering to those guidelines. Maybe agreeing with them might be a stronger term.
So my final question, what's the next step for you regarding in your department in this city regarding autonomous vehicles?
So I think the next step is to just continue the discussion, right? There's a lot that we need to learn from one another. We have a really unique environment here in Pittsburgh where we do have a number of different autonomous vehicle testing entities who have shown an extraordinary amount of goodwill to engage in these dialogues. Here we have this really exceptional opportunity to bring the industry together with the stakeholders, with the policymakers, with the regulators, and have this very, very important dialogue about what do we want? What are our values? What can you bring to the table? Where do we draw the lines around the things that we won't tolerate? And so that's really the next step, and that's what we'll be doing over the next 2 to 3 years. And then testing some of those cases out and seeing, can we actually demonstrate that in very constrained and safe test cases and see where that might actually be of mutual benefit across all entities.
Karina Ricks is the director of the city's Department of Mobility and Infrastructure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, the National Council of Jewish Women's Pittsburgh chapter is looking at big picture solutions to make voting more accessible 100 years after Congress approved the 19th Amendment. And companies including Range Resources agreed to pay three Washington County families $3 million after allegations that fracking made them sick. Get more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Megan Harris with the Pittsburgh Almanac. 70 years ago, on June 5, 1949, the restaurant Eaton Park launched with a 13-stall drive-in on Sawmill Run Boulevard, or Route 51, in Pittsburgh's South Hills. It was part of the Big Boy restaurant chain and advertised as Pittsburgh's first modern eat-in-your-car food service. The restaurant's car hop system lasted 20 years before being phased out in favor of automated order-taking machines. Today, its many dozens of locations feed Pittsburghers around the clock, and its iconic smiley cookie can be shipped anywhere in the nation. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Yuengling Brewery in Pottsville, Pennsylvania is celebrating its 190th birthday this year. The oldest brewery in America survived Prohibition, 2 World Wars, and more recently boycotts prompted by the owner's support of presidential candidate Donald Trump in 2016. The Yuengling family has maintained control of the company for 6 generations. As WHYY's Jimena Condi reports, it's not just the bosses. A portion of the company employees also go back at least 2 generations.
It's making the trays. This is a tray maker. See how it's stamping the trays? And then the 2 12-packs will sit inside of it.
Stacy Belulis can talk brewery visitors through any of the moving parts that go into bottling their choice of Yuengling beer. From the machine that takes flat cardboard rectangles and punches them into trays, to how the beers are bottled. Belulis has worked at the brewery's gift shop and museum in Pottsville for 5 years. Her job includes giving tours, and Belulis seems like an obvious choice for the job. Her relationship with the brand began long before she worked at Yuengling. When Belulis was growing up, her dad stocked the fridge with the beer.
That's what he drank all the time.
Her first beer was also a Yuengling.
The big 16-ounce bottle is the premium. They were 16-ounce, right? Returnable. Yeah, the returnables. Boy, that was back in the day.
And Belulis's husband, Adam, is a 13-year Yuengling veteran who works in bottling.
Over there, you just basically watch and make sure that the bottles are filled and they have the cap on the top, the crown.
When I was a kid, I'd picture myself playing baseball professionally. I'm not going to lie to you.
Belulis says the benefits and work schedule at Yuengling prompted him to leave his job at an aluminum plant. When Stacy Belulis's father came out of retirement to drive trucks again, he went to the brewery too.
So now he drives for Dick. He loves it.
She's talking about Dick Yuengling Jr., the owner and fifth generation Yuengling to run the company. The fact the brewery has remained in the family for generations is a point of pride, and it's just not the top brass that stayed. Company officials claim 10% of its 150 employees at its Schuylkill County breweries go back at least two generations. That includes Charlie Sibbett, who worked up the courage to approach Dick Yuengling Sr. back in the 1960s during a softball game.
And I says, how about getting me a job at Yuengling Brewery? And he says, you want me to give you a job at Yuengling Brewery and you're drinking Mount Carbon beer?
Mount Carbon was a competing brewery in Pottsville.
I says, well, I'll drink Yuengling beer if I get a job.
Sibbett retired in 2001 after 37 years of delivering beers for the company. During his tenure, things changed in Schuylkill County as the once booming coal industry continued to decline and other smaller breweries that served those miners, including Mount Carbon, closed their doors. Yuengling also struggled financially until Dick Yuengling Jr. took over from his father in 1985 and made the company and its traditional lager a household name. Charlie Sibbett's son, Kevin, grew up blocks from the Pottsville plant and would deliver beers with his father to cities like Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. Eventually, Dick Yuengling Jr. made Kevin Sibbett an offer.
He said to me, he says, I'll hire you on one condition. And I said, what's that? He says, I don't see you here in 10 years. Well, that was 31 years ago.
Sibbett says Yuengling wanted him to go on to do bigger things, but Sibbett stuck around. He's now one of the company's lead brewers at its Mill Creek facility just outside Pottsville. If you ask him why he stayed, the answer is simple. He loves brewing beer. Though the company is not the county's largest employer, local economic development officials say Yuengling is the county's marquee brand because it's so well known and draws visitors from all over the world. It's also valued because of the reputation it has with employees. Stacy Belulis says if you can get a foot in the door, you can stay for life.
People don't leave here. There's people here for 40 years. There's a reason for that.
It's why she and her husband, who are both in their 40s, plan to stay for a long time. Ximena Condi in Philadelphia.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The National Council of Jewish Women Pittsburgh Chapter is hosting a panel discussion Thursday by women for everyone on current voting rights issues facing our community at their annual meeting at the Jewish Community Center in Squirrel Hill. Christina Ruggiero is the executive director of NCJW Pittsburgh. Glad to have you here, Christina.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
I am well, thank you. And Tessa Provins is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Pittsburgh. Welcome, Tessa.
Thank you, Kevin.
Tessa will also be the panel moderator at the Thursday event. In your minds, what are the most pressing issues preventing a fair, equitable right to vote? Christine, we'll start with you.
Oh, wow. Where do we start? Okay. So as the reason why we're doing this panel is to get people engaged and understanding about what these issues are before we get to 2020. So some of the major issues are access to the ballot in terms of accessibility of people being able to exercise their right to vote. Issues regarding the census, meaning how we're going to count all of our citizens and people in the country in order to get representation, which becomes a very important issue. We're also talking about fair and safe voting machines. That's a big issue in Pennsylvania. So a lot of these issues that we will be covering on Thursday are relevant both locally and nationally.
And it varies from state to state, accessibility to vote, whether you have early voting or not, whether you have absentee voting and the like. So what are you particularly going to talk about regarding Pennsylvania and the access to vote? Tessa.
So some of the things that are actually going through the legislature right now and being considered are things like automatic voter registration for individuals who are 16 and 17 years old being able to do absentee voting and no excuse absentee voting in particular. And what we're seeing is that that will expand the ability for individuals in Pennsylvania to be able to vote.
You mentioned 16 and 17 year olds. You're not talking about giving them the right to vote. It's just to get them registered in advance.
That's right. So currently in the state Senate, there's a bill that would allow automatic registration. So basically, once they get their driver's license, PennDOT would sort of get their information, and then once they turn 18, then PennDOT would send them an application to register to vote. Whereas in many states, it is an automatic process where PennDOT tells the state, oh, this person's eligible, they're registered.
And so you're not just looking at the 2020 election, because you mentioned the census question, because that'll only kick in the 2022 election, those numbers and who is a citizen, who is counted, and who can vote.
Correct. But we need to be aware of these issues before we get to 2020 or 2022. And for example, with the census, one of our panelists, Faye Alabi, will be really talking about what the city and the county are going to be doing in terms of getting people aware about the census, what the impact of the census will have, again, in terms of policy, in terms of representation, and then also looking for census ambassadors. We need people to educate all of our residents in the community about what it means. And so when census workers come to your house and literally ask those questions, people will be comfortable and ready to answer.
Efforts at voter suppression, they're nothing new. Just this week, we celebrated the 100th anniversary of Congress passing the 19th Amendment, granting women the right to vote. But it still took another 46 years to pass the Voting Rights Act, and many Native, Latino, and Asian Americans were denied the right to vote into the 60s and 70s. Are you surprised that there are still efforts going on to suppress the votes of eligible citizens today? Tessa, we'll start with you.
No, not at all. We've seen a number of things across the country, including voter ID laws, the access to absentee ballots and things like that, that are lowering individuals' ability to vote. One of the major things is that there's high costs in some cases to participation. We can imagine instances where individuals have to work during those days, that they have to go far distances, that maybe they don't have access to transportation to get to polls. And so we see these high costs, and being able to lower costs to vote and also give people access and the ability to vote is really important. So there's definitely work to be done, and Pennsylvania is trying to do some of that in some of these bills.
And unfortunately, in some states, those pieces of legislation that may seem neutral on their face, right, even from the hours in which your local poll is open or not. If it closes at 6 p.m. and you work a full day, well, there's a cost there. Can you take time off from your job? Will your employer allow you to do so? Or if you have early voting, for example, which we don't have in Pennsylvania, then you have a number of days in which to make that happen. So that's kind of what we're talking about when we talk about the cost that people would incur or not.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking about an event tomorrow evening that hopes to educate voters about ballot access, political pressure over voting systems, and more. Christina, what's the role of states in determining policy that prevents things like voter suppression?
The role. Well, I mean, I think that's a good thing for us to remember, because sometimes we don't look at our local or state legislatures and policymaking as a place where our rights and abilities are effectuated or enabled. Good example of this is talking about how right now in the news, there's all these issues around abortion rights and right to choose, right? Most of what people don't realize is that the Supreme Court can make all sorts of decisions, but the legislation enabling those rights happens at the state level.
Right.
So just like with voting and other policymaking, state legislatures are the places where your ability to choose or your ability to vote is where those decisions are going to be made.
Tessa.
Systems of participation matter at every level of government. So these systems are supposed to lead to individuals' policy interests being represented. Elections at the federal, state, and local level are the first step in making sure that elected officials are being held accountable at the polls. At the state level, we're seeing state legislators have a lot of power.
Just since the 2016 elections, I think there's been a dozen or more states that have taken various actions. In fact, they have enacted bills and measures and created a variety of new restrictions. And even this year, Arizona and Tennessee enacted new restrictions. Are you seeing any attempts to restrict voting here in Pennsylvania? If so, what are your concerns? Christina.
Yeah, I think I don't see the legislation or legislative bills in Pennsylvania actively restricting, but I would say that some of these proposed pieces of legislation are not truly expanding access. When we talk about no excuse absentee voting, there's now, because in Pennsylvania, it's very restrictive in order to be able to be eligible to submit an absentee ballot. And then the time in which you have to submit it is very short, again, to compare to other states. So there is a opportunity to expand that, but it's not truly expansive because it's only allowing people who are out of the municipality who can use the absentee ballot. So anyone who works a double shift or is a emergency worker can't take advantage of this. So in some ways, in Pennsylvania, the issue is, well, there's sort of one step forward and another one step back. I mean, we did a number of years ago did see the Pennsylvania state legislature and the governor try to pass a voter ID law that was then found unconstitutional. So we're not quite back to that strong pieces of legislation that are actively seemingly restricting different groups of people. But the legislation that is going forth is far less, really not giving as much accessibility as we
think
it is.
Far less progressive?
Correct. And so when they say, oh, we're really opening the ability for people to have access to vote, maybe not so much.
Well, polls are open in Pennsylvania from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Would weekend voting help?
Absolutely. I mean, that's when a number of states have had the ability to have extended voting or early voting. That's what we're talking about. If you have a number of days in which to exercise your right, then that makes it easier for you to figure out when to make that happen. If you have one day a year to do that, and for example, Pennsylvania doesn't have a law that says employers are required to give you 2 hours off in order to vote. That's like a law. A number of states have that, like California. So what if we made voting a holiday, right? And I know there was a bit of a news in Ohio where they made Columbus Day now their election day because that is a holiday. So there's many ways that states, our representative governments, can make our access and ability to exercise our right easier.
Is that something that the NCJW Pittsburgh is working to promote, to get into law?
So what we're trying to do with this panel is to really get people aware of all these issues and to understand why they're important, and they're important now before elections happen, before we start thinking about big presidential elections and things like that, but also to get people engaged. And we have a number of organizations that are working on these sorts of campaigns, like PA Voice, Human Rights Campaign Fund. So we're going to have other organizations in addition to our esteemed panelists where people can actually start working on these sort of campaigns about these various issues, like modernizing Pennsylvania's election machines. That's a really big issue that the state legislature and the governor is facing right now. And what we decide to do there is not going to be an insignificant decision.
Right. And they're required to modernize those machines in time for the 2020 elections.
Correct.
What do you say to those who would suggest these are just attempts to thwart voter fraud? Christina.
There's been very little evidence that fraud or fraud exists. I think that's often brought up as a reflexive concern. If anything, the big concern should be about our electoral systems, particularly modernizing them and making sure that we're being protected from being hacked and from manipulated. And again, in Pennsylvania, that's where, if we're talking about any sort of manipulation of the vote that's likely to happen, that's where it's probably going to be.
What can we be doing better or differently to better include marginalized communities in the voting process? I'd like to hear from each of you. Christina first.
I think the first thing is to recognize, what does it look like to be able to vote in these communities? How many voting and polling places are there? How many volunteers are there? I mean, these sorts of questions, which may seem very obvious or simple, reveal a lot, meaning that poll workers are people who volunteer, right? This is not something that there is like an army of employed people working the polls. So if you don't have enough people to station a polling place, then you can't have one there. How easy is it to get to the polling place? If your polling place is a number of miles from your house and you only have public transportation in order to get there, what does that look like? So those are some of the things I think when we talk about various populations and their ability or access to vote and how that may differ in different parts of our community, that's one thing. Those are some things to look at.
Tessa, better involving the marginalized communities.
Absolutely. So one way that we can do this is by trying to get individuals from marginalized communities to register to vote and making sure that that's a priority moving forward. Another is, like Christina said, getting access. Remember that voting can be high cost in some cases. And so making sure that individuals are provided support in order to cast their votes.
So what do you hope people will come away with from tomorrow evening's voter rights discussion? Tessa, we'll start with you.
I'm hoping that people come away with a better understanding of some of the issues that are being faced at the Allegheny County level, at the Pennsylvania level, and also some of the broader national issues with regard to voting, and also that they're going to come away with some really tangible ways that they can be active in politics and in elections and think about policymaking at the state level.
Christina.
I would second everything that Tessa just said, and to say that when we think about the policies and our representation, and when people feel like, what can I do, or this doesn't represent me, or I'm concerned about a policy that may be implemented in my state that I don't want, well, it all comes down to representation. And if we don't think about the rules and the legislation and the institutions of voting itself and to expand and enable that right, well, everything flows from that. So if you're going to be complaining or frustrated with policymaking, well, that starts with who you are voting at the ballot box, and which means how are we enabling that right to vote.
Christina Ruggiero is the executive director of the National Council of Jewish Women, Pittsburgh, which is hosting a panel discussion tomorrow evening on voting rights. And Tessa Provins is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Pittsburgh. She will be the panel moderator. The ticketed event begins at 6:30 tomorrow evening at the Jewish Community Center in Squirrel Hill. Thanks to both of you, and good luck tomorrow night.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 10 years ago, Range Resources established a fracking site in Washington County and was eventually sued by three families. Some details of a settlement were released yesterday, but not before a lengthy legal battle and an attempt by Range to prohibit media groups Allegheny Front, State Impact Pennsylvania, and WESA from publishing that information. Joining us now is Reed Frazier, the reporter who legally obtained documents outlining settlement details. Welcome, Reed.
Hi, Kevin.
Briefly, Reed, why did the family sue Range Resources in 2012?
Range built this site in 2009, and kind of right away, the family started smelling foul odors in the air and in the water that came into their homes. And pretty soon thereafter, they started reporting health symptoms.
What kind of health problems?
Well, according to the testimony that they gave to in the court case, they reported nosebleeds, headaches, dizziness, extreme fatigue, skin rashes. One of the plaintiff's sons was diagnosed with arsenic poisoning.
So they sued in 2012. It took years for this $3 million settlement, didn't it?
Yes, it was a lengthy court case. Just to give you an idea of how much legal paperwork was generated from all the motions and appeals that went back and forth over the years. The docket, which is essentially the table of contents for this legal case, is over 100 pages long. So you can imagine how much paperwork was generated in this litigation.
Quite often, when we hear that a settlement has been reached, documents are sealed, plaintiffs agree not to talk about it. How did you find that information?
I was looking for information regarding the case. It's a little background here. The Post Gazette was still trying to get the settlement unsealed. I went to a hearing in that case, and then after the hearing, I went down to get some more background on the case. Kind of the only way that the public is allowed to see these court documents is actually to go into the courthouse prothonotary's office, look at it on a computer. You know, you have to sign in on the public access, and it was just sitting right there. I eventually found it.
But it should not have been there?
Apparently not. It was a sealed document. The prothonotary or somebody in the courthouse put it there. The judge said in court yesterday that it had been there probably since February, and that they had just failed to delete it from the public side of their database.
You mentioned court yesterday. You and some WESA personnel were in court yesterday. What was Ranged Resources trying to do?
Well, they had initially asked the judge for an injunction from us barring the document. When I reached out to them last week to get comment on the existence of the settlement, that we had it in our hands, within a few hours, the judge had agreed with them and enjoined us from publishing the documents.
Enjoined you until a hearing could be held, is that correct?
Right, and this was basically, the judge did move very fast, timely, to get a hearing scheduled to sort the issues out.
So are the families now allowed to speak publicly? If so, have you talked to any of them as of yet?
Well, even though the settlement is public, one of the terms of the settlement is a non-disparagement agreement.
So you can't criticize the companies?
Yeah, they can't say bad things about the companies that they alleged, you know, kind of made them sick. Mm-hmm. So they are, you know, not allowed to speak. We do know from a book that was written about this case that recently won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction, that the settlement left them, the book doesn't mention the terms of the settlement, but they told the reporter, Eliza Griswold, that it was, you know, sort of a defeating amount to have gone through six years thousands of, right, you know, papers of court documents filed in this, that they were left feeling angry and defeated.
The book, Amity and Prosperity. You mentioned that the Post-Gazette is also involved. They're hoping to get the full settlement released. What's left to learn?
Well, there's 10 co-defendants in the case. We don't know what the other... we know because Range released on their own accord their total amount that they paid into the $3 million. They paid $1.88 million. We don't know what, you know, how the rest of the companies were divvied up. But, you know, the PG may want to continue the case to sort of set, you know, just sort of set some precedents for having these settlements revealed to the public, issues of public import.
Yes. So in a sentence or two, what do you think? Do you think the court ruling yesterday is a precedent or just a decision very specific in this case?
Oh, I don't. I'm not the right person to ask that question, but... You know, I think our lawyer for the media companies kind of pointed to some very famous precedent cases where the courts simply are not allowing the government to prevent the press from publishing ahead of time.
Reeve Frazier is a reporter for Allegheny Front and State Impact Pennsylvania. His work is also heard on WESA. Reed, thanks so much.
Thank you, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, it's the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Pittsburgh contributed soldiers and sailors and equipment vital to the Normandy invasion. Plus, we'll have a visit with a 94-year-old Pittsburgh veteran who treated the wounded while under fire. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.